Thanks for coming. This is going to be a chalk talk, so if you have any questions in the middle, please interrupt. And I would like it to be more like a two-way street rather than just me giving like a lecture type thing. So, okay. So I have a rather concrete goal in this talk. And basically, this talk will be divided into two parts. In the first part, I ought to discuss certain technical tools concerning approximate quantum error correction, which will be independent of topology. But I want to present it in such a way that I will cut out the parts that doesn't seem to be too relevant to holography and only focus on the parts that is relevant to holography. And in the second part, I would like to solve a certain problem that I am personally interested in holography. Okay. And at the end of the day, I have a goal, which is somewhat concrete. And the goal is something like this. So we all know that we have some notion of locality in the universe that we live in. And this fact can be formalized in many ways. If you assume that there's a Lorentz symmetry, then this automatically gives you some form of causality. But even if you don't have any Lorentz symmetry, let's say you have a dynamics generated by a locally interacting Hamiltonian. For instance, you can imagine having a spin chain where these are qubits. And you can imagine the time evolution is generated by some operator like this, where H is a Hamiltonian that is a sum of terms which are acting on, let's say, two nearest neighbors. In this case, a theorem by Lieb and Robinson shows that there is an effective speed of light in this locally interacting quantum many body system. So for instance, if you have an operator, let's say here, and if you have another operator, let's say O subscript B here, then the commutator between the time of old version of OA of T and OB, its operator norm is upper bounded by something like this. Some proportionality constant times the operator norms times the exponential of some constant V times T minus the distance between A and B. Here, V is a constant that only depends on the, let's say, the coupling constants of this Hamiltonian, the local terms of this Hamiltonian. And this is called as the Lieb-Robinson velocity. And what this tells you is that for any state, there is some sort of locality. In particular, there is an effective light cone so that if you quantify your correlation by this commutator, then there's an effective light cone so that if the distance between two is large compared to Vt, then in this region, in some sense, correlation is very small. In fact, it decays exponentially in the distance between A and B. And I would like to derive something like this in the context in which the Hamiltonian is not necessarily local, and also the context in which the structure of the Hilbert space is a bit unclear. So here, the reason why you can derive a bound like this is because A, H has this nice form. And secondly, you already know what the Hilbert space structure is. It's basically a tensor product over these individual qubits. And it seems, and I sort of care about this because it seems that in holography, the notion of locality is somewhat more relaxed than something like this. So let's see. There's got to be one more. Oh, okay, I guess that guy is just stuck over there. Okay. So this is ordinary locally interacting quantum many-body systems. In holography, it seems that the appropriate notion is something like this. So you're not necessarily you are still interested in the commutator between one observable that is located at some region A, evolved by some time t, and another operator, let's say, located at a region B. But you're not too interested in the commutator in the entire Hilbert space, but you are interested in the commutator in a certain subspace. So P is here is a projector onto a certain subspace. And of course, this depends on what kind of subspace you're interested in. In later examples, I will actually explicitly discuss what are the subspaces that I'm interested in. But at the end of the day, what I want is a bound that looks like this. Some function of t and distance between a and b, so that if you plot this function in, let's say, three dimension, roughly speaking, in this region, the value of f is a small. And in particular, as d increases compared to t, this value becomes smaller and smaller. This is essentially what I want. So like, you might be curious about why I'm interested in this. The first, there are basically two reasons. Yes?
Can I ask you about the setting?
Yes.
What's the distance? So what's A and B?
A and B, that you have to specify. And in every...
Are we talking about the boundary or the bulk?
In the bulk. Yeah. So you have to come up with the coordinate system, and then you have to define what it means to have an operator at a particular location. This I will do.
So the background, there is a background metric though that you're going to use to
Yes. I have some. So P is spanned by a certain set of states. So as soon as I specify the states, with respect to that state, you can define what it means for an observable to locate it, let's say, here or there. Okay. And it doesn't seem like this has any immediate applications, but a couple of years ago, I met Elliot Leeb, and he told me that when he first came up with this, he thought this was completely useless. And then after like 30 years, like Matt Hastings came in, and he proved all these like Lipschultz-Matze theorem in higher dimensions and like exponential decay of correlation. So I guess the lesson is, he told me that you shouldn't be too concerned, even if it doesn't have a very nice application. So far, this is my defense against preemptive defense. Okay, so how would one show this? It seems like this is somewhat difficult because there are a lot of moving pieces. For one thing, as Gifre asked me, I didn't even specify how you can define an observable that is located here or there, and I didn't even specify what the appropriate subspace is. And I'll consider three examples, hopefully, if I have enough time. And in every example, I will go through the following line of attack. So I'll first define a subspace.
So, sorry.
Yes?
Are you claiming that this is something that holds true in general, or is just you're trying to prove three kind of separate...
Three separate things
of this form?
Yes, three separate things. Define subspace, and I'll choose OB to be the logical operator of this subspace. And I will try to understand the error correction capabilities of this code. In particular, I will consider the erasure error and ask what kind of erasure errors can this code correct. And then I would choose this OA of t to be a quote-unquote the error, and it'll be chosen as, and by construction, the smaller the value of t is, the smaller the absolute value of t is, it'll be easier to correct this OA error. And as t increases, this error may become more difficult to correct. And lastly, then I'll apply well-known quantum error correction conditions to derive a bound like this. Okay, this is our route of attack. All right. And in this pursuit, it'll be useful to describe what is known as quantum error correction dualities. I want to first start with the case in which there is no approximation error, meaning that given an error model, I'm asking whether it is possible to perfectly reverse that error or not. And then I want to discuss a generalization, which includes the approximate case. That is, you have an error model, and you're asking whether it is possible to reverse that error up to some finite precision epsilon. And the reason why we care about these is because they're useful. So if you look at the definition of quantum error correction condition, it's something like this. So you have an error model, which is specified by some quantum channel, and you ask for the existence of some quantum channel that reverses this operation. But this means that in order to verify this, starting from the very definition, you sort of have to come with the explicit recovery map, which is not always easy. But the nice thing is that there are equivalent conditions which are sometimes easier to actually verify. So the idea is to use these equivalent other conditions and then verify that. So there are three conditions that are exactly equivalent to each other in the context of quantum error correcting code, at least if you concern yourself only with erasure errors. So one is the correctability, what I call as correctability. And it says something like this. Suppose you have your input code state row, and you undergo some error channel, which in this case is a partial trace over some subsystem A. And we say this error is correctable if there exists a CPTP map R such that you can revert the state back to its original form for all input code state. One example would be like the toric code. I think most people will be familiar with the toric code example. So imagine you choose your A region to be a set of these four qubits on the edges. That's your A. And this is basically saying that if you remove these qubits and replace by some fixed state, you can basically reverse that operation. And it turns out that this is equivalent to the so-called cleanability of a logical operator. So what does this mean? So we're still using the same subsystem A, and the cleanability states that for any logical operator, say UL, there exists a representation of that logical operator that lies outside of a region A. Mm. So this is just an encoding map from the logical, the abstract logical Hilbert space to the physical Hilbert space. So on the left-hand side, you're encoding and then applying a logical operator UA bar. And on the right-hand side, you are applying the logical operator and then encoding. Okay. And in the context of tutorial code, again, this is sort of easy to see. In query code, you have two logical operators, the x-like string operator and the z-like string operator. And the given any simply connected small enough region, you can always choose the x operator to avoid that region. Like one example would be this string of x. And you can always also do the same thing for the logical z operator. In this case, it would be a string of z, like this. So z, z, z. Okay. And this is true not just for toric code, but for arbitrary quantum error correcting code. And it turns out that these two are actually equivalent to another condition, which is called as local indistinguishability. I wish indistinguishability was a shorter word. But what it says is that if you look at the reduced sensing matrix over a subregion A, for any code word, you end up getting this exactly the same reduced sensing matrix. So the reduced state over A is exactly equal to omega A, where this guy is a fixed thing that is independent of the code word. Okay, are there any questions so far? So what's tricky about approximate error correction is that it's not as easy as just putting epsilons here. Because it turns out that some of these it turns out that between here and here, the equivalence just remains intact. But as soon as you try to relate these two, conditions to the local indistinguishability, something not so good might happen. And this happens when the number of code words becomes too large. And basically, the problem comes from the fact that if you want to if you want to understand what happens in the worst case scenario, if you have, let's say, two to the n number of code words, and if you just apply the naive bound based on triangle inequalities, you end up incurring this two to the n prefactor, and that can potentially mess up your bound. So you have to use the right definition, and in particular, this becomes important when the number of code words becomes large. So the robust version looks like this. So the first one is the correctability condition. So here this is a identity super operator. So you're plugging in the input a code state and taking a partial trace. And this code state can be potentially entangled with some reference system. But even in those cases, you want this thing to be true. This is the approximate correctability condition. And that is equivalent to, this is unpublished, by the way. But hopefully it appears can appear in a few weeks or so. So what are you doing here? So given a logical operator, you're choosing the best representation of the logical operator that lies outside of A, and then you're considering the worst case scenario over all logical operator. And there's some proportionality constant factor, which is like 2. So if you go from here to here, if this holds for epsilon, then you get this inequality up to epsilon. If you have this epsilon, then you get this inequality with 2 epsilon. But the real tricky part is this local indistinguishability. And the correct version looks something like this. So you want the So you're asking whether the reduced density matrix of the subsystem is equal for all input code states, but you're actually considering arbitrary code state that is entangled with some reference system, and then you're asking whether the subsystem A is actually decoupled from the reference system. Okay. Any questions so far?
So here, rho r can be depending. It can depend on the ground.
It can depend on this. Yes. Yes. I mean, you're plugging in a state that is entangled with your physical system, and you're plugging in an entangled state between the physical Hilbert space and some reference system. And therefore, you can do anything to the reference system. So this just depends on the input.
But why is that not something you would have demanded there as well?
Are you asking why this is different from this one in a significant way? I guess all I can say is that it really boils down to the following fact. So there's a channel such that it's let's call this guy as a completely depolarizing channel. Then there's a channel such that the one norm is like epsilon for arbitrarily small epsilon, but like the diamond norm distance is like bounded from below by like 1/2 minus some constant or something. And the existence of this channel, once you massage things in a correct way, tells you that there is a situation in which this can be arbitrary, this can be hold up to an arbitrarily good accuracy, but this simply does not hold. I can tell you about this more later. It's a bit technical.
Looks like you've done two things. You've gone from an example that was for finite code or finite dimensional case, exact. You're preparing the setting for an infinite dimensional situation.
Yes.
And also error.
Yeah. I mean, here. I mean, like, I drew a toric code, but the statement itself holds for like any finite dimensional system, and there's no like dimension dependent factor when you're trying to relate this to that to that. But as soon as you have epsilon here, epsilon let's say here, and if you want to convert from here to here, that's actually not a problem. But if this holds for epsilon for all code state, and if you want to convert that back to here, then there's a unavoidable dimension factor, and the fact that it's unavoidable can be traced back to the existence of that channel.
Yeah, so just a quick comment here. Yeah. The local indistinguishability condition should have involved a reference upfront, I think.
That's
the more natural way to think about it.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, like, it's just that I think in most quantum error correcting codes that naturally appear in physics, it seems that the code dimension is rarely increases with the system size. So people normally don't think about, like, usually in most cases this is okay, but in certain situations they're not. Yeah.
If it's perfect, they're the same.
If they're perfect, they're the same. Yes. Okay. All right, so it's time to go through some examples on how to use this. Let's see. So the first one is like a warm-up exercise. There will be certain things that you'll need to take it for granted. This comes from what I read from high-energy physics literature. But this is basically coming from my work with Michael Castriano in 2017, and also there was a related work by Xiaoliang Qi and Zhao Yang in 2017. Let me first start with the setup. The setup concerns ADS-CFT, and I'm not going to claim that I understand everything about ADS-CFT. But it is a purported equivalence between the quantum theory of gravity in asymptotically ADS space, anti-de Sitter space, and the ordinary quantum field theory in one lower spatial dimension. And the question that I want to ask is the following. So it seems that the fact that you have a good semi-classical quantum theory of gravity suggests that there is a well-defined notion of locality. And the question is, like, why do you have a light cone that looks like this? And there are certain facts that I want to, that I would like to assume. And these facts are the following. So pictorially, you can imagine a quantum field theory that lives on a circle. So this boundary is a place where where the quantum field theory lives. And you can imagine having things like spins, or qubits along the boundary. And the boundary Hamiltonian is generated by some ordinary Hamiltonian that is locally interacting, bounded, all those good stuff. So there's an effective light cone on the boundary. That means that if you do something at time t equals zero, say here, and if you wait for time t, then the region that you can influence after time t is bounded by a region whose size is, let's say, order ct, where c is the speed of light. And inside, you have a bulk which is purportedly described by quantum theory by an ordinary gravity general relativity. And and the setup is this. So we're considering the following code subspace that is spanned by two states. One is a ground state of the CFT, which corresponds to the empty pure ADS space. And we're trying to consider another state, which is created by acting a bulk observable, let's say O1, located at a particular point in the bulk. Let's say it's specified by two coordinates, X and R. X is a boundary coordinate, and R is a coordinate in the radial direction. And you have defined two states, and if you consider a subspace that is spanned by these two states, you have a subspace and you have a quantum error correcting code, which in itself doesn't really tell you much because you haven't specified what kind of properties this code has. According to a recent literature by Dong, Harlow, and Wall, these operators can be reconstructed based on the so-called entanglement wedge reconstruction. What it means is the following. So you're given a bulk observable, let's say O1x, R, and you want to ask whether it is possible to reconstruct this operator from a particular boundary region. So let's say I want to ask the following question. I know this boundary region A, which I specified. Is it possible to reconstruct this operator from this boundary region or not? According to their prescription, which I will assume to be true, this operator can be reconstructed if and only if this operator lies in the entanglement wedge of the boundary subregion. So what you do is this. You have a hyperbolic space. You have your observable. And you have your boundary region. And what you do is that you draw a minimal surface that is anchored on the boundary of this boundary subsystem A, which are these two points. And if O1 is enclosed in that region, which will happen if your choice of A is this larger region, in that case, this operator can be reconstructed from this boundary subregion. Is this clear to everyone? So in this case, you won't be able to reconstruct this operator from this dashed region, but you will be able to reconstruct this operator O1 from this larger region, because the minimal surface that is anchored on these two points encloses this O1.
So reconstruct this operator means its action on the ground state?
Its action on the ground state.
And that?
Yes, yeah. Not, yeah, that's right. Let's see. So at this point, we have finished part one, actually. So we have defined what the subspace is, and so we have so far done part one, and we're on our way to doing part two. So we haven't really specified what it means, specified the error correction capabilities of this code against erasure, but in a way we did. Because you see, that's kind of up there, but if you see here, the condition about whether you can reconstruct the operator from a certain boundary region or not is precisely corresponding to the cleanability condition. So here, let's see. Okay. So for instance, this O1 cannot be reconstructed. Any operator that is located at this region cannot be reconstructed from this dashed region. And therefore, if you believe that this qubit is encoded somewhere, it better be encoded in the complementary region. Let's say. In this red region. And that exactly corresponds to the fact that you can clean the operator away from the certain region, in which a region A, because here this red region corresponds to A bar. And then you can use this duality to infer that locally, actually you can just go directly to this route and see that the erasure of a subregion A is actually correctable. Then the argument goes as follows. Let's say you have an operator which can be thought as an error, let's say O2, evolved by some time t. and you want to consider the commutator between O1, located at bulk point x, r, and a boundary operator O2 of t in this subspace, which you have already defined. Now here you can commute O1 through P because this is a logical operator in the code subspace. And then you realize that there was a constant speed of life on the boundary. So O2 of T, its support will increase, but it will with finite t, there's only so much its support can increase. So initially, this O2 at time t equals zero will be correctable from the in this erasure of a region that supports O2 of t will be correctable for some finite t, and then at some point we will no longer be able to say anything. But while the erasure of a region that supports O2 of t is correctable, what you can end up using is this local indistinguishability. So when t is sufficiently small, you end up having some constant that depends on t times p. And what you end up getting is that of course, there's an approximation error. But basically, this is the like a cartoon version of how you derive a bound like that. And I don't see like a completely general, like all-encompassing way to find the subspace, but. There are many, it seems that there are many physical situations in which this line of logic is applicable. To my knowledge, the first non-trivial example in which we could show an effective light cone like this was in my work by Michael Castriano. And what we consider was the second example, which is based on the Mara construction. So, here our goal was again very clear. So we wanted to define a certain quantum error correcting code which seems to naturally occur in quantum many-body systems, and then define as some form of effective light cone. So how do we do? So where do we expect such a code to exist? So one natural case is when you have a quantum many-body system that has a Mara description, and the reason why we think this is reasonable is because Giffre and his collaborator have done a lot of numerical work using Mara to simulate critical systems. And it seems that it is capable of reliably reproducing the Lorentzian physics with a modest bond dimension. So assuming that the Mara representation is a good approximation of the CFD ground state, we can simply start with a single state and observe that this is a quantum circuit from a simple product state into a highly entangled state. And by simply replacing one of these legs from a fixed input state zero to a arbitrary input state, you can formally define a code. So this is formally, this code is formally a map from this logical Hilbert space into this physical Hilbert space. And what we found was the following. So imagine you want to look at the, compare the expectation value of an observable O of t that's evolving in time. And you want to compare this expectation value with respect to one input state. Let's say V is the encoding isometry. And another input state, say psi prime. So how would they differ? It turns out that Mara has a very nice structure. I mean, this has been observed a long time ago. But it's the fact that if you start with an observable that is localized in some bounded interval, let's say length L, then if you look at the evolution of this observable as you go up through this tensors, this evolution can be broken down into two stages. In the first stage, what happens is that the support of this observable decreases monotonically. And the way you can see that is by observing that this tensor network has a certain hierarchical structure. So here, what is happening is that you're applying a depth 2 quantum circuit, and then you're contracting by, then you're applying an inner product with respect to these bunch of zeros. And you can see that these zeros are placed in such a way that for every bounded region, you're roughly taking an inner product with respect to zero on half of the number of qubits that you initially have. So as you start from here and move up, the size of the support increases to, let's say, at most by L plus 4. But as you move across this line, the support of the operator is basically halved. And here, again, at most, the support can be increased by 4. And then you move up. And the support of the operator is again halved. And this process repeats until the support of the operator is it becomes bounded by some constant. And then what happens is that you basically apply a unital channel to these operators, and the generic unital channels has by definition it has identity as a fixed point, but the other things generically will have the other eigenoperators of the unital channels will generically decrease in norm. And by utilizing this fact, you can see that this thing is basically bounded by some constant times e to the minus alpha divided by alpha times r minus log vt. So what is r? R is the total depth of the circuit, essentially. And with this, by basically going through the same logic, you end up having a bound like this, yes?
What is time here?
Time is time and the boundary. So there is a local Hamiltonian on the boundary. So it's important to remember that
Is there any relation between this Hamiltonian and the circuit?
I think so.
Is that the Hamiltonian of the critical spin chain for which this represents the ground state?
Yes, so OT is this thing where this is the critical Hamiltonian. So it's important to note that the even, well, first of all, like if you don't have like any locality in the boundary in the first place, then I wouldn't really know what to do. So in that case, I have nothing to say. But while you have a local Hamiltonian on the boundary, it's unclear if you have a local Hamiltonian in the bulk. Like this is a unitary circuit. So imagine writing down a Hamiltonian like this, U, dagger, where U is this entire unitary. This will generically map a local Hamiltonian to a highly non-local Hamiltonian. And it is totally unclear as to why that non-local Hamiltonian should give you, in some sense, an effective light cone in the bulk. But what this shows you is that if you restrict yourself to the right subspace, then even though you can't really say anything about the locality of this particular Hamiltonian, you can still get some notion of light cone. And this is possible because you have a understanding of what kind of entanglement structure you have in the ground state in the low energy subspace. And of course, I'm a little biased, but I think this is quite nice because ultimately, yeah.
Can you help me or us understand why is this? You're saying that you see some speed of light.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just don't see it from the expressions. Can you explain the expression?
Right. So this bound. Let's try to plot something. So when does this bound become order one? So here, r is the distance between two observables. So this bound becomes order one when t is, exponential in R.
So you're saying when the support at the boundary has expanded enough that it hits.
That's right. That's the only way you can hit this guy.
Without having been exponentially suppressed by the unital operator.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Okay. Let me just draw this for completeness. So this is like a log plot, and essentially in this region, correlation is extremely small. This is what the bound is saying. So, all right, so I guess I have 10 more minutes. Are there any questions so far?
Sorry, I'm still trying to visualize.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So you have time versus uh-huh. scale or R.
Uh-huh.
And this correlator is the difference between these two expectation values.
Uh-huh.
You're saying that it's going to be very small
uh-huh.
until the observable has had time to expand.
That's right, yes.
And that is so. How do I see that this is a commutator again?
Oh, good. Yeah. So I'm using the fact that O1 is a logical operator, so you can commute through a P, because that's a projector onto the code subspace.
One is the one is how you encode the which state you have on the hub.
Yeah, so this is where the O1 lives. And yeah, I'm so sorry. I guess I didn't specify O1 and O2. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So O1 is living up there, O2 is living down there. And this phi becomes roughly proportional to the projector onto the subspace, guaranteed to be roughly proportional to the projector onto the code subspace for a time that is small compared to exponential in R.
And this projector is simply the two states, the ground state.
And grounds, yes. Or, yes.
Well, psi and psi prime, two choices of psi and there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You can imagine like sticking in 0 and 1. Yeah, right. Yeah. Just spanned by those two states. Okay. So the third part is still work in progress, but let me just state the problem. So it's the problem that I want to solve is establishing bulk locality in the entanglement shadow, which I guess not everyone is familiar with. But basically, it comes from the following observation. So what we considered so far is just pure ADS space. But in actual holography, you also consider asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. And one extreme example is a geometry that contains a long wormhole. So if you restrict yourself to a region that is close enough to this boundary, let's say here and here, it looks like an anti-de Sitter space, but clearly towards the middle, you you're not in the actual pure anti-de Sitter space. Okay, so what happens is that apparently there are regions for which the entanglement wedge reconstruction gives you insufficient information about how to reconstruct the operators. So more concretely, what is happening here is that you can imagine, first of all, if you draw the entanglement wedge, it turns out that the minimal surface that is anchored to a boundary that is smaller than half of the subsystem cannot really reach all the way through the middle. They're sort of just stuck near the boundary. And you can reach the middle if you want to include a subsystem whose size is larger than half of the boundary subsystem. But the thing is, in this rather huge region, there seems to be a large amount of possible choices to ascribe local operators to different bulk points. For instance, you can imagine having a bulk operator located here and bulk operator located here, whose distance is large compared to some metric. And in order to construct these two operators, it seems that you always need to have a more than half of the boundary subsystem. So if you were to use a line of logic that is described in example one, example two, you simply won't be able to say much because, well, let's see. O1 initially is an operator that is supported in a huge region, and then evolve it in time, and becomes O1 of two. It's another operator that is supported in a large boundary region, but we don't have this nice tensor network structure. So what can you possibly say there? And the correct way to interpret this, which seems to generalize the case one and case two, is to consider the complexity of these operators. So in the quantum information context, a relevant reference is due to Brandel, Harrell and Horodesky. Two thousand twelve. and they consider things like polynomial T design. And in their paper, there's a blurb that says something like this. So suppose you have a unitary, which is polynomial, like let's say, which is a T design, where T is a very large number, let's say, poly N design. And suppose I can at most apply some, suppose the best I can do with my unitary is producing, let's say, two design. And that's my resource. So I have like a limited number of gates that I can apply. And then I want to kind of decode what happens to a quantum code that is encoded by this poly T design circuit. And then for if your decoding circuit has a certain restriction on the number of gates that you can use, then with respect to those circuits, it turns out that you cannot actually decode the quantum information, which is a kind of tautological. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that in the context of holography, there is a sense in which there is a folklore that the deeper the operator is into the bulk, the more complex this operator is. And therefore, in this case, if we imagine this operator is more complex than that operator in some sense, then if you evolve this operator by some time t, there's a limit on how much more complex this operator can be. And therefore, this operator will be unable to decode any information about O2. I can be a little bit more specific, but that will take another 30 minutes. So maybe I should stop here and get some questions. Thank you.
Can you give some reason why you get the limit amount, why you get log instead of the linear in time?
Oh, good. So the reason why you get log is because so the ordinary Lee-Robinson bound tells you that if you evolve this operator by time t, you can approximate it by another operator, let's say O2 tilde of t, which is strictly supported in a region whose size is like order of vt. And let's imagine you coarse grain this operator by going up in the vertical direction. And let's say we do that for a distance little r, then it takes, let's see, so in r equals roughly order log l steps, the size of this, the supportive of this operator becomes order one. And at that point, the norm of the operator is guaranteed to be contracted. So you basically plug in L equals VT. And that's the difference between, so this is like the total number of contraction that happens by applying this transfer operator.
Yeah, there was work by Pastowski on approximate error correction for, if you look at subregions of CFTs, the compression code, if you kind of run it backwards in a sense, it's an approximate error correcting code, right? And Mera also, you know, if you run it backwards, you could more or less intuitively understand it as a compression code. So my question is, you know, what's the pattern here, right? Like it seems like many systems that have certain classes of Hamiltonians, maybe that need a holographic dual, maybe not, but it seems that compression codes for certain states that occur in nature are nice for approximate error correction. And I'm asking, you know, how general could we kind of push this pattern? And seems to be the case here too, to some extent.
So this Pastowski, are you thinking about this low temperature Gibbs state of the critical Ising model paper or something else?
Yeah.
I guess I don't have anything useful to say aside from the fact that, if you're kind of uncompressing the quantum information, it feels like you're sort of embedding into a larger Hilbert space, which if you do it sufficiently uniformly, then you get an error correcting code. But this is all very vague.
Yeah.
So that's all I can say at the moment.
Right. Any questions?